Bet365 is paying out before the final whistle.
Check out Bet365's unrivaled early payout offer. When you bet on a team to win and they take a 17-point lead, you get paid no matter the final score. Forget the final whistle and start counting that cash. Hold up. You get early payout on parlays, too.
Download the app and see why it's never ordinary at Bet365. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. 21 plus only. Must be physically located in Ohio. T&Cs apply.
Forget the pressure to overhaul your life. The new year doesn't need a new you. It needs you. Grow Therapy helps you make meaningful change at your pace and on your time. Grow connects you with thousands of independent, licensed therapists across the U.S., offering both virtual and in-person sessions, nights and weekends. There are no subscriptions, no long-term commitments. You just pay per session. Grow accepts over 100 insurance plans, including Medicaid in some states. Sessions average about $21 with insurance, and some pay as little as $0, depending on their plan. Visit growtherapy.com/try now today to get started. That's growtherapy.com/try now. Availability and coverage vary by state and insurance plan.
Hey, this is Nomar Slevic, author of UFOs Over Maine, and you're listening to the Ghosts in the Valley podcast.
Hello and welcome to Ghost in the Valley podcast. I'm your host, Al Cooley. Today I'm celebrating my 200th episode. I'm really excited about that. It's only taken me over 7 years to get to this spot. Hey, we're still here. We're still rocking and rolling. And tonight I have Timothy Wayne Williams as my guest. He's an artist, an author, a painter, a musician, and so much more. I can't wait to pick his brain and get into our conversation. But first, I want to have a special announcement. I will be on Christina Spencer's podcast for the whole month of February. So make sure you tune in every Friday night at 9:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And Christina is going to be reading chapters out of my book, Spencer's Ghost. Then on the last Friday of February, I will be on the show talking about any of her questions and about the book. And the name of her podcast is The Horror, History, and Hauntings Library Podcast. I'll have that in the show notes, and thank you, Christina, for having me on and making me the author of the month of February. So without further ado, let's get into my conversation with Timothy Wayne Williams.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it very much. Yeah, I appreciate that.
I want to point out how behind your name there, you know, because you, that's impressive when you're not just, say, per se an author or just a painter, and we relate on being a musician, you know.
And, so
we're gonna get all that. I want to get into that fun size bacon.
I invent things that are like kind of no-brainers. It's like fun size bacon is just where you cut the bacon in half so it fits in the pan better. See, I came up with that one day and I was all like, I have invented fun size bacon. World, you're welcome. Okay. But now, my claim to fame, Al, the thing that I'm most proud of, and I want this on my tombstone, I think, is I invented the word snoverdose. That is, it has a couple meanings. It means, like, if you get more than 8 inches of snow, that's a snoverdose, okay?
All right.
Or it could just be eating too many snow cones. You know, either one. But, you know, so that, I mean, that I'm most proud of, probably.
Or don't eat the yellow snow, you know.
Yeah, well, there's that, yeah. Yeah.
Thanks to Mr. Frank Zappa, yeah.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, I always find that these little sayings that pop up, you know, that stick with me, you know, and and how we get to say connect to different people, you know. Mm-hmm. I came across you through Christina Spencer's podcast.
Yeah.
And I seen you on another podcast. I can't think the name of it right now. But then I was referred to Christina Spencer by the fine host over there at the Seekers Chronicles Paranormal podcast. You know, mm-hmm. I've been on their show, they've been on mine. And, you know, it's such a tight-knit family in this paranormal. Oh, yeah. How somebody knows somebody, somebody knows somebody.
Oh, and, yeah, yeah.
I found you very fascinating, and I want to get into some of your stories.
Oh, I appreciate that.
And my first question is, what got you interested? Let's start with being a painter. I mean, what led you into that, becoming a painter?
Ah, okay. I was a musician for a long time, which I think we've talked about a little bit. And I was all in on becoming a rock star. And when that completely fell through, I was, you know, out of school. I had no money. I was like, okay, what do I do now? Well, I went and my kind of fallback was being a printer. And I worked at a screen printing company for years. And I ended up becoming like the graphic design guy there I was kind of a supervisor there too. But anyway, while doing that, I started painting every, you know, now and then. I experimented with it. I had just mentioned to my mother-in-law one day, I was like, I'd love to try painting sometime. I always thought that was cool. Well, so she got me a paint set, like, that Christmas. And so I started messing around with it, and I really felt like I took to it really quick. As a matter of fact, I like to tell people, like, in the first year of painting, I was doing like commissions, just like, you know, one after another. I made more money in 1 year painting than I did the whole time I was playing music, which is crazy because I did really well in music. I was very close to, like, quote unquote, making it. That's a whole nother story unto itself, but, So I started doing, you know, fine art shows and everything along with my day job. I had modest success, you know, I've always been into the paranormal. And then one day I was listening to a podcast actually on Bigfoot, and, I just was doing this landscape, and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be hilarious if I just hid a little Bigfoot in the background here? You know, I just won't tell anyone. I'll just do it for my own amusement, you know. And so I did that, and didn't think anything about it. And I ended up doing a couple dozen paintings, you know, where I sold the paintings and never told the people there were Bigfoot in them. I just honestly didn't think anyone would be remotely interested. And so there was one time I was having a really slow art show, and I ended up, just to keep people in my booth, I started telling them, hey, see if you can find a Bigfoot in this painting, you know. And people were really digging it. And before I knew it, I had, you know, a ton of people in my booth looking for Bigfoot, you know, in my paintings. And I thought, well, this is an interesting way to get some eyeballs on my painting. And you know, and plus, you know, I love the topic. So just, I ended up, you know, combining these two things, and I was able to quit that job of 33 years and, you know, become a professional oil painter. And I'm super fortunate, really. I'm definitely not becoming rich, but I'm not destitute.
So I was looking at some of your paintings today. I was like, wow, this is phenomenal.
And, thanks.
So what leads you to, okay, today I'm gonna paint flowers, or tomorrow I'm gonna paint a cabin. I mean, do you plan that, or is it spontaneous? How do you plan your paintings?
You know, I don't. This is the cool thing about what I do, is like I can paint pretty much whatever I want, and you know, so I just paint whatever I want to. You know, there's sometimes I like to challenge myself. I'll like say, okay, I'm gonna put these three colors on the palette, and that is all I'm gonna use. I gotta see what I can do with these three colors, you know, and that's super fun. And so yeah, I mean, it's like sometimes I'll do a landscape, and every now and then I'll do a still life. I used to do a ton of still lifes. Now I just really whatever kind of catches my fancy, you know, just anything, really.
Yes, I love the pictures of. I mean, I love photos and portraits of trees, especially as my mother used to always say, "Why do you have a dead tree on your living room wall?" I mean, my wife and I just love the tree. It's more of a fall picture because you got the orange background. You know how branches just stand out at, like, say, at sunset?
Oh, yeah.
And that orange behind the tree. And we're going down the street, down the road all the time. We'll say, man, look at that sunset over there. I just really dig that, you know? Oh, and yeah. So we bought a porch and put on our living room wall. So my mother came over and says, you have a dead tree on your wall. You know, like, it's not really a dead tree, Mom. It's in the fall. And so my wife's mother came over. And she said the same thing. Why would you have a dead tree on your wall? It's like, I'm like, oh my God. so we always love that type of, you know, and to each their own. I'm sure you come across that quite a bit on maybe what some people like this better than that, you know,
it's weird. When I did fine art, there was kind of an unwritten rule. I had some other artists tell me they were like, never do winter scenes, you know, because people, you know, the amount of people who like the winter scenes is way less. You know, your odds are better, you know, selling that if it's a, you know, nice, pretty winter, you know, happy or a, you know, summer or spring thing. And I found like with doing the paranormal stuff like I do, those people don't care. They like the kind of moody, kind of spooky, kind of, you know, thing. And plus, you know, who's to say that doesn't mean that, you know, just because it's a tree without any leaves that, you know, I mean, it's coming back, you know, mm-hmm. it's on its way back. So, you know, there's hope there, you know.
I want to get to your book, you know.
Oh, okay.
Your Bigfoot Expeditions. I thought that was really well thought out. Well-planned book. I really do.
That means a lot. I'm real proud of that idea, and I still think it's got more legs. I think it could be bigger than what it is right now. Mm-hmm. But you know, I started out where I thought, you know, I don't know if anyone would want a book. I'll do a calendar. You know, let's start kind of small. So I self-published one calendar, and I ended up getting with a publisher, Doug Hychek, who's kind of known in the paranormal world, or mostly like the cryptid world. He used to produce Monster Quest. Well, Doug's kind of a friend, and he likes my work, and I was like, hey, let's do a calendar together. So we put out a couple calendars together, and that was all good. And I actually got another publisher to do my book. And I was like, well, if people really like these calendars, it's like, well, you know, calendars have like a shelf life, you know, they're like, you know, after a while, no one's going to buy them, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I was like, I want to do a book that's, you know, forever green. And so, yeah, it's basically, I guess I should describe this. I do these hidden Bigfoot paintings. And the book is set up. It's like you're going on your own expedition. It's basically a coffee table book of my art, but, you know, you have Bigfoot in there to find. And so it's kind of fun. You know, people who like my art love it. And then people who are just into finding the Bigfoot and don't care about my art love it, you know. And it's like, it's funny. It's like, my publisher was like, well, are we calling this a kid's book or what? I'm like, 99% of the people who buy it are adults, mm-hmm. you know, so I'm not sure I would call it a kid's book, you know, so we didn't really know where to put it on Amazon, but we have in a couple different things. But
yeah, because Amazon wants you to label whatever you're doing.
You know? They're big time into that.
Right. It's kind of like my book, you know, Spencer's Ghost. So it's about a true story growing up in a haunted house. So you're targeting.
Yeah.
I think that your concept could target anybody, younger or older.
That's same as mine. That's what I keep saying.
Yeah.
Keep telling the publisher, we need to market this everywhere. You know.
So was that a spinoff of your calendars? Your calendar?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. So what you have a fascination for Bigfoot or?
I mean, all things paranormal.
Okay.
It probably started with Bigfoot because I'm of that generation, you know, who watched the show In Search Of when I was a kid, you know, the one with Leonard Nimoy. And my dad came and got me and said, you got to see this. And, you know, and it was the episode of, you know, the Patterson-Gimlin film, you know, where I first saw Bigfoot. I had no idea what this was, and I was blown away. You know, it's like monsters could be real. And so, you know, between that and then my uncle actually gave me a book. I think it was like a Time Life book. It was called like Strange Stories and Amazing Facts or something like that. And it was just nothing but just spooky, paranormal, strange stories. And I read that thing cover to cover so many times. And so between those two things, it absolutely, you know, solidified my interest in the paranormal.
Yeah, have you had any experiences with that?
I have. No cryptid encounters, really. Kind of wish I did, but no. But I do have. I have two stories that I tell quite a bit. But one is I would call possibly a demonic event, and then I have one that I think is kind of an angelic event. When I was, this is the demonic one. When I was in high school, I was in a band, a little rock band, and we were doing pretty good. And we had saved up a bunch of money and we decided to put on kind of our own little showcase. So, in the next big town, it was Anderson, Indiana, there was it's hard to explain what this was. It was kind of like, I think they call them pole barns, but it was just like this really kind of prefab, like barn building type thing. There was like nothing to it. And I think they rented it out for people to use for like weddings maybe or things like that. There's nothing to this. It was like a shell of a building. It had two garage doors for like load in and load out. And then it had one main door that was to let the crowd in and out. Then there was some seating, it had a stage, and it had like a bar that was just, you know, didn't have anything in it. If you wanted to sell anything there, you would have to bring it with you, you know. So anyway, we had saved up all this money, real excited about this show. So the night before the show, all us people in the band were standing around the soundboard, you know, kind of in the middle. And we were saying goodbye to each other, just like, hey, you know, I'll see you tomorrow. Yeah, we're all good. Everything's cool. We had shut everything. We're getting ready to go out the front doors. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, we hear this loud laugh, this cackling, creepy laugh. And we look up, and there is this man sitting on one of our bass speakers, bass woofers. And he's just laughing his head off. Just, I mean, almost falling backwards laughing. And we're all looking at each other like, what the hell? We're like, where did this guy come from? And what the hell is so funny, you know? And it was freaking us out. And we're all like, well, you know, we're getting ready to go. So we're like, we got to get this guy out of here, you know? So everyone kind of pushes me forward. So I had to go up to the guy. So I'm like, hey, man, you know, what are you doing here? What, you know, what can I help you with? And he was like, hey, I got something. You're going to love this. You are going to absolutely love this. And he reached behind his back, and it was unbelievable how he did this. It was like straight out of a cartoon, you know, when like Bugs Bunny reaches behind his back and like pulls out a mallet or something. You know, it's always like something's ready behind his back. Yeah. That's kind of what this guy did. He put his hand behind his back, and when he pulled it out, he had a stack of Polaroids between his thumb and index finger that was, he could almost not even hold it because there were so many of these Polaroids. And he took them out and he started going through them, showing me, and they were crazy pornographic. And I was all like, oh, okay, maybe this guy's like a pimp or something. He snuck in somehow, and he's hitting up all these, you know, 17-year-olds who have no money whatsoever. I'm kind of like, what is this guy doing? But anyway, I'm like, no, dude, no, absolutely not. Not interested in that. You need to go. And then he said, no, man, what do you need? What do you need? And I'm like, okay, is he a drug dealer? You know, I'm just like baffled what this guy wants. And I said, man, I was a little forceful with him. I'm like, dude, we don't want anything. You need to leave. And then he got real serious and he made real strong eye contact. And he was like saying, no, really, what do you need? Just tell me what you want. What is it you want? And the way he got so serious, you know, because just moments ago he was cackling, laughing, having a good old time. And then suddenly he just, a switch flipped and he's like staring me down, wanting to know what I want. Like the thing I want most in this world. Freaked me out. So one of the guitar players kind of wandered up, thank God. And he was going through the Polaroids. I had to kind of pull him away. And I'm like, no, I don't need anything, dude. I'm like, okay, we're just leaving. You need to leave too. So he starts kind of like laughing again. And then as I'm walking away, I get right back to the soundboard, not far away, you know, not far away at all. And I've been trying to think about how many feet it was. It's been a long time. Maybe 20 feet, if even that. Probably not even that far. And in the time it took for me to just take those few steps back, and we all kind of huddled up, and you know how you do that thing when you're getting ready to talk about somebody, and you look over your shoulder, you know, to make sure they're not listening, you know, because you don't want them to hear. In the time we huddled up, and I look over my shoulder so the guy wouldn't hear, and the guy's gone. And I'm like, okay, where'd this guy go? And we're all like looking around like, he's got to be hiding. Where's this guy hiding? You know, because the garage doors were shut. We had shut and locked those. And that's what he was closest to. He would have had to walk right by us to go out the front doors. I mean, right by us. And we're all like, he's got to be hiding in here somewhere. And then, you know, we started worrying about all our equipment and everything. And so we're frantically going through this whole place, which is nothing. There's nothing to this building. You know, I can't stress that enough. We're looking everywhere. I even looked under my drum riser, which is, you know, just, I mean, it's like a foot high. It was nothing, you know, but there is a space to crawl underneath there, you know. So we checked it out. Never did find the guy. We were fairly certain when we left that night that that guy was not in that building. So we, you know, to this day have no idea who that was, how he came in, and how he left. You know, none of us saw either thing happen. And to this day, you know, it totally weirds me out, you know.
Do you think maybe something happened in that building? I mean, where were you playing at?
It was, you know, it was just this place you could rent out, you know. Oh, so okay, there was okay. All kinds of, yeah. I mean, there could have been anything in there.
Right. You don't know the past history of that, of the building.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody died there, got killed there. You don't know. Yeah.
There was a bar that was close. And that was our first thing, was kind of like, okay, he's wandered over from the bar. But the thing was, I mean, still, again, we would have seen him come in or leave, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So we don't think that was the case.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, some people have said like, oh, that's your crossroads moment. You know, that was, he was offering you a chance to, you know, if you would have said what you really wanted, you know, mm-hmm. maybe he would have made you a deal. And I'm like, I'm not sure I believe in that, yeah. but I would say, but I would say, I'm like, you know, as I got older, I was like, I don't know. Maybe that was, you know.
Well, the reason I asked that is because about a year ago, my wife and I went to see a tribute band in Canton, Ohio, an Eagles tribute band. Mm. And after the show, you know, I like these smaller theaters because you can talk to the band afterwards and share stories, you know. And I was talking to the bass player, and I says, "How are you enjoying Canton?" You know, he says, I really didn't see much of it because we're like, they told us we could stay here in the theater. There's rooms for the band. Mm-hmm. But we got the hell out of here because it was too active. And here it's known to be an active theater. Mm. And a lot of artists I've played there have witnessed activity. That's why I just asked maybe somebody else had some similar experience there or.
Well, I will say this little offshoot of that one. I did rehearse in a haunted theater one time. Long story, but there was a guy who became our manager, and he was an attorney. And he this was a different band I was in, and this one guy had owned a very famous theater downtown Indianapolis, and it was called the Rivoli, and it was built like in the 20s, and it was built by MGM, and like Charlie Chaplin performed there. You know, it was back in the day that the big these big movie networks or whatever you call them, they would build their own theaters, you know. And so this theater had been around forever. Well, the guy who owned it turned it into a porno theater. There is sort of I'm sure you're seeing a pattern here now.
Yeah, I'm seeing this pattern.
Solves porn here.
I wasn't going to say nothing, but you know.
Yeah, this guy, he just stuck this screen on the stage and showed porno movies. And he had gotten into all kinds of financial trouble, and our attorney was trying to help him. And to pay off some of the fee, he let us rehearse there. And, it was so haunted. Now, I did not see much, but some of the other guys did. And one of the things I thought that was real freaky was the guy said, I wasn't there for this, but the guy who owned it said, hey, if you stay till, I think it was like, I don't know, 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. He said, if you do that, you can look through. And he had some sort of night vision, maybe infrared sort of a thing. And and this is kind of gross, but he had to buy this because there was stuff going on in the seats that he had to keep an eye on.
Oh yeah.
And so he had to be able to see in the dark. And he would tell us that there were times that he would be up in the projection booth and keeping an eye on people. And he knew he sold like 8 tickets and there was suddenly 9 people in the theater. And he would run down to chase this 9th person out, and they wouldn't be there. And he'd go back upstairs and look through the night vision stuff, and said uh-huh. that the person was back, you know. And some of the guys stayed late, you know, to that 3 o'clock. And he had said that if you stay till 3 o'clock in the middle of the theater, this little white mist would form. And he said it was right like clockwork. You could see this. And the guys who did stay and said absolutely something did form right in the middle of that theater. And it could only be seen through that infrared or whatever it was.
Yeah, I've been seeing a lot of that. You know, like a lot of these old theaters that they remodeled or whatever, trying to bring back to life. And
yeah,
I think they disturb a lot of stuff that's going on there.
Yeah.
And same thing with the churches. You know, a lot of activity in these churches. I've been doing this podcast. So you said you were this close of making it big, being a musician. I mean, what happened?
I'll make it real quick. I had an original band in the early 90s in Indianapolis, and we were starting to make some waves. We were doing really good. We wrote really good songs. And we got the attention of that attorney I was telling you about. He was an entertainment lawyer, and he had heard about us, and he checked us out and was like, hey, you guys are pretty good. You know, maybe I'll be your, you know, management. And we agreed to it. And he had lived in Toronto, and his dad had owned a law firm in Toronto. Well, he still owned a law firm in Toronto, and that law firm handled a band called Triumph. Triumph. They were huge back in the 80s, you know. Mm-hmm. And Triumph, probably second biggest rock band to come out of Canada. I don't know. But they were huge in the 80s. But our manager, the attorney guy, got a tape to Triumph. And he liked our band. He said, yeah, these guys are going to make it. I'm fairly certain, you know. And he said, hey, tell you what, why don't you guys come to, I think his studio was called Metalworks or something like that in Toronto. He's like, why don't you guys come up and record? And you know, we were like, oh, hell yeah. And so we were rehearsing to go record, and we were actually waiting for Guns N' Roses to get out of the studio. They were mixing like one of the Use Your Illusion albums, I think it was. And they were taking forever, as you know, if you know anything about Guns N' Roses, they took mm-hmm. forever to do anything. And so it, you know, if they would have just left when they were supposed to left, I probably would have still been in the band. But they screwed around, and in that time, things got heated. We were a bit stressed, and there was some stuff over what songs we wanted to do. And I had been rehearsing the certain songs we were going to record, and then they decided to not do those songs and didn't tell me. And so anyway, it ended up this huge blow up. I basically got fired out of my own band. I literally started this band. I mean, everything. The name of the band was in my name and everything. And but the management sided with the two other guys, and me and the guitar player left. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I didn't get my big break that I, you know, thought was going to happen. But, I mean, like, Gil Moore was just, yeah, he was like, oh, yeah, you guys are absolutely going to make it. He had no doubt. And, so, yeah, that all blew up, and it was after that. It was not long after that where I had told my mother-in-law. I was like, I can't just start and try it all over again to become, you know, a rock star. I'm just not doing it. It just, from literally the sixth grade on, that's all I wanted to do, and that's mm-hmm. all I worked towards, you know. And when it ended, I was just all like, yeah, I'm done. I'm absolutely done, you know.
So. Yeah, I know. I know how you're saying, yeah, because same here, you know. I mean, we were so close also, you know, and making CDs. And, you know, when you record somebody else's song, you have the copyright, you know, or the mechanical right of it. And
sure.
That was kind of funny because you mentioned the Guns N' Roses, because we were wanting to record Knock on Heaven's Door. And naturally, Bob Dylan wrote the song, so we had to go through his publishing his own through Ramhorn Music. Mm-hmm. So we had to go through Ramhorn, and that was a whole story in itself, you know. So it's like step after step after step. And he had mentioned his people got back to us why it's taking so long, because they listen to everything that you want to record from Bob Dylan. Because ever since Guns N' Roses did Knock on Heaven's Door, he was totally pissed. So we were like, well, what's that got to do with us, you know? So we were
no kidding.
And we got it was just thousands and thousands of dollars we're spending on our own. I mean, thousands, literally thousands of, I mean, even on playing places, we got to pay to play, you know, like, if you want to get on that ticket to open up for, I mean, whoever, like Dave Davies from the Kinks or Steppenwolf or whoever we're opening up for, we had to pay And the more tickets you sold, the closer you got to the main act. You know what I'm saying? Oh, so we ended up buying a lot of our own tickets just so we can get close to have a better crowd there, right? Now, so I can relate with a lot of musicians on here. And when you said you were this close, you know, it's like, that really sucks because, you know, you are that close.
I will say this. In my mind, I was that close. Who knows? Maybe I wouldn't have made it. But, I mean, that was the closest I had got. I mean, the right people. Matter of fact, I didn't tell you this part. We had done some recording, and one of John Mellencamp's guitar players came in, and he ended up producing it because he kind of liked what we were doing. And he just happened to be in the studio, and he was all like, let me go ahead and produce this demo. And, you know, so, I mean, things were trending in the right direction, you know, and then for it to all fall apart, you know, I was depressed for years. It was so awful.
I want to jump back here for a minute on your paintings. Let's say you sell a painting, and I know the original artwork is going to be more money than, say, a printed version or a lithograph, whatever. Mm-hmm. Do you have come across where you didn't sell that painting because it meant too much to you?
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. I have one in my closet right now that I don't even take it out. I just want to keep it perfect and set aside, you know. I did early on when I first started painting, I had all these lofty goals, and I was out kicking my coverage. I was trying to do stuff that I was not ready to do, but I went for it anyway. And I was all like, I want to become a Renaissance type artist, and I'm going to do biblical themes, you know? And so I did a gigantic painting, and it was literally 7.5 feet wide by 5.5 feet tall, something like that. And it was a Noah's Ark, and I like researched it. And I even talked to professors at IU about what a mountain would look like after a great flood. And I wanted to do, you know, after the flood, and the Ark would be, you know, in the mountains, and what that would look like. So I did all this research on it, and I painted it. And that one, I gave it to a church. And the day I had to give it to the church was rough, because it had sat on my living room wall for about 2.5 years when my kids had just been born. And like my kids, well, not just been born, but they were really small. My kids had like never not known that painting to be on the wall. You know, it was so big, I couldn't put it on an easel. I just took it, put it on the wall. And, you know, that was weird to me that the kids were all like, wow, that is, never saw that painting not there, you know, and to give that away was rough. But I visited it. I saw it about 3 years ago, and it was still in great shape. I'm shocked. I really was shocked for not knowing what I was doing. It turned out well, so I was kind of happy about that.
What about if you painted a painting, let's say, and you sold the painting, right? Mm-hmm. And you can always, you know, you're making your money off of the copies, right? What if somebody wanted that same painting, but wanted the original? Would you repaint that painting?
Yeah, well, a couple things. I almost never do prints.
I was going to ask that. Yeah.
Yeah. There is a company called Fine Art America who has some of my images that I've given them. And they'll it's like a print-on-demand thing, and they'll print. I mean, they'll put stuff on a shower curtain. They don't care. You know, they'll put it on anything. And I have sold some prints through there, but not many. I really don't like doing prints. It's a long story, but I saw a bunch of painters kind of abuse that when I was doing fine art shows, where they would get prints and they'd put a little bit of paint on them and try to pass them off as originals, you know, and I hated that. So, yeah, I don't do a lot of prints, but as replicating a painting, I get asked to do that all the time. And I will do it on the condition that it's not going to be exactly the same. I will get close, but I don't want to do the exact same painting. I don't think it's fair to the person who owns the original of that. And most of the time, I will even ask the people who bought the original if they're okay with that, if I can, you know, replicate it, you know, to some degree. And if I get the blessing of that, I'll do that. The cover of my book is owned by a lady named Amy Boo, who's a she's from Ohio. She's a Bigfoot researcher and really sweet lady, and she owns that painting. And I've had at least two times where people wanted that exact painting, and I've asked her, "Can I do something very similar to your painting?" And she said, "Absolutely." I will. Yeah, sorry, it's a long way around to get to that, but yeah.
Well, yeah, you know, because like a musician, sometimes when you, you know, I don't think there's any musician out there I've heard of or know that when they record a song, they wish they could have done it better, or they could have went back and they could have fixed something on it. You know.
Oh yeah.
And I've done that myself. I was just curious if you've done that on going back. Like I think I heard you say, if a painting doesn't sell, you will go back and try to like fine tune it or make it a little more colorful, or you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Or sellable.
Yeah. I'll do that. Matter of fact, that happened not long ago. Just for instance, I love doing seascapes, and I had done this seascape, and I was really proud of it, and nobody was interested. Just no nibbles at all. And I put it aside in the studio, and I just kept an eye on it for a while. And then one day I was all like, I know what this needs. And I put a Viking ship in it and sold it. Like, after I put the Viking ship in, I sold it in like 15 minutes. So, you know, it's just like, that's what it was waiting for, you know.
I like your Bigfoot book, your paintings there in that book. Now, were those paintings done and then you added Bigfoot later, or did you add Bigfoot? No, and I'm going to put him in there.
A little bit of both. Some of those were older paintings I had done before, you know, I'd really committed to, okay, this is going to be my life now, painting Bigfoot and paintings, you know. And some of them, it was like, okay, I need another fall painting, you know, for the fall area of my book. And so, okay, now I need to, you know, paint something for fall. And so, you know, a little bit of both. Some were existing. Some of them I did notice once I had blown them up really big. I was checking the resolution for, you know, to be used in the book. And I realized that, oh, this Bigfoot didn't come out quite right. It works like if you saw the painting, you know, in real life, but in the book, it's not going to work. So I did digitally go in and tweak a few of the Bigfoot to make them just a little more visible.
I seen you on a former podcast today. I was just scanning through to see what I can dig up on you, you know?
Cool.
The word Wendigo was brought up, and you didn't want to repeat that word again. What was the reasoning? I mean, I know a little bit, but I'm going to let my listeners know.
Yeah, I mean, I'll say it, but I don't like saying it a lot. The thing was, it was another podcast that I had done, and the guy and I had become kind of friends after I'd done his podcast, and he said, "Hey, I had this an encounter with a Wendigo. Would you paint my encounter?" And at the time, I was like, "Well, sure, yeah, I'll try. You know, this could be a fun, you know, challenge." And so he told me all about his encounter. I took a bunch of notes. And I sat down, I was working on it, and I thought, this will be easy. I absolutely know what I'm doing here. And I kept sending him, like, progress pics, and he was like, you know, it's just not quite there yet. And so I would go back, and I'd work on it some more, and it just was not going well. And then there was one night, I put it aside, and I do that a lot. I just put paintings aside, and I'll just walk by them, you know, every day and just kind of keep an eye on them. And every time I'd walk by that painting, and, you know, I just was getting creeped out, more and more creeped out by it. And then one morning I woke up, and I had had a horrible nightmare, and it involved a Wendigo. And the other real weird coincidence was I had not heard that word, you know, forever, you know, except, you know, why I talked to that friend of mine. And it's like within, I don't know, an hour and a half, I must have saw that word pop up like five or six times, it was just uncanny, and it was creepy. It was like I sat down, was listening to something, some sort of podcast or something, and someone was talking about some actress or something, and they were like, well, I was thinking, what was that movie? It's like, or what movies has this person been in? And I, you know, checked IMDb, and the first movie this person was in was Wendigo. And then like two other things happened right one after another, and that name, you know, it picked up again. And then, you know, later on, just like hour and a half later, I saw it, you know, two or three more times in just weird places, you know, just scrolling on the internet, and all of a sudden that word would just jump out. I'm just like, this is creepy. I had to finally get with the guy, and I'm like, listen, you know, I'll paint almost anything, but I'm like, I really don't feel good about this. I'm like, I'm, you know, having nightmares, and I'm seeing the word everywhere. And I'm like, I hate to do this. I don't think I've ever told anyone that I can't do their painting, but mm-hmm. I said, I cannot do it. And he was very understanding, and he was very cool about it.
That, when you said so strange, it was strange for me today when I came across that, right? Because and then I did a little more research on Wendigo.
Yeah.
And it's like, because you got Skinwalker, you got Bigfoot.
Yeah.
Dogman, you know, but you have Wendigo's like its own. I mean, the Native American Indians don't even mention it.
Yeah.
They don't talk about it. So like you were saying, you know, because it's not a good thing. So.
Yeah. I mean, there was a long time where I wouldn't even, like, I'd say it maybe once, and mm-hmm. then I wouldn't talk. I've gotten past that a little bit. I'll say it, but I don't.
What do you got coming up? Any places you're going this year to sign or show your work?
I'm going to be, I always think I got to write these down. I will be at the Ohio Bigfoot Conference at Salt Fork, April, I want to say, maybe May. I think it's May. I'm sorry, I should know these dates. I always forget to write these down. I will be in the Indiana show in Nashville, Indiana. I will be in I'll probably do CryptidCon in Kentucky again. So yeah, here and there, mostly Midwest. Oh, I did get invited to go to Oklahoma to open up a gallery.
Oh, that's sweet.
Yeah, so that I'm kind of excited about that. I think they're paying for my whole way, so I'm super excited about that.
Yeah, I mean, send me the information. I'll put the links at the bottom of this episode where you're going to be at. Yeah. So people can follow you, and also the links where they can buy your paintings.
Yeah.
You know, so I'll put those links in there as well.
I love Ohio. I tell people it's like Ohio, Indiana, it's basically the same state.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, I've got basically almost the same weather and
the people are the same, you know. Yeah. I always feel better like if I'm on a long trip. As soon as I get in Ohio, I feel like, okay, I'm home. You know.
Yeah. I mean, well, my wife went to Italy and she came back, you know, and we were going to go to Cedar Point in Sandusky, Ohio, and we got to talking so much. I passed the exit up. I mean, I'm near Youngstown, right? So we're traveling halfway across the state, three quarters across the state, and then passed up Sandusky, passed up, heading up to Toledo, and right into Indiana. You know, welcome to Indiana.
Oops.
Yeah. Thank you, Timothy. I appreciate your time and stopping by and talking to me.
I appreciate it. It's been fun.
Thank you, Timothy Wayne Williams. Please check out all his links at the bottom of this episode. And also, every Friday of this month of February, I'll be on the Horror, History, and Hauntings Podcast Library on YouTube. The links will be at the bottom of this episode as well. Christina Spencer will be reading chapters from my book, and then I'll be on the last Friday at 9:30 p.m. in February. Please, if you have a chance to listen to it, maybe you might want to pick the book up after you hear a couple of these chapters, if you haven't already. Thank you very much from the bottom of my heart, Christina. And also, I appreciate every single one of you. I'm your host, Al Cooley, Ghost in the Valley Podcast.